On Friday, November 2nd, the 8th Engineers Support Battalion and the 6th Marine Expeditionary Unit out of Camp Lejeune was task ordered to go to New York and New Jersey to assist in the relief efforts in the wake of Superstorm Sandy. Stephen O'Connell talked with several Marines in the 8th Engineers Support Battalion in the last 2 weeks to find out how they've been helping out.
On Saturday, November 3rd, the 8th Engineers Support Battalion out of Camp Lejeune left for New York and New Jersey. Sergeant Ramlell of the 8th Engineer team might be the only Marine of the 88 who has experience. Sergeant Ramlell was stationed in Okinawa last year when mainland Japan was devastated by the tsunami.
I was part of the task organization unit that sent gear and Marines over to help evacuate. So I have experience as far as what gear is needed and how much of it will take to have that operation happen. But coming home and having it happen here in our hometown, it's a lot different because it hit home a lot more to speak to the fact that it's now happening to us.
Ramlow grew up in Queens, and although he is stationed at Camp Lejeune, he lives in Morris Plains, New Jersey. Sergeant Ramlow has been helping operate water pumps and clearing debris for the past 2 weeks. We spoke with him last Thursday evening, the 8th.
We started cleaning the streets up today, and sanitation crews has started coming in and sweeping up the streets, and we're planning on bringing in equipment to clean the sand off and stuff like that, but a lot of it is slow going, block by block.
The Department of Defense asked the Marines of Camp Lejeune to go down and help with relief efforts, and Camp Lejeune then chose the 8th Engineer Support Battalion for the job. They were picked for their specialties. They are a team of combat engineers, bulk fuel specialists, motor transportation Marines, and communications Marines. Public information officer for the battalion, Lieutenant Tim Irish, says many of the Marines volunteered to go. We spoke with Lieutenant Irish on the 8th to find out what they'd been doing during the previous 5 days. Lieutenant Irish is originally from Rochester, New York.
A lot of it's just been driving up and down the beach, seeing where the Marines can help the most, and then they go attack it, clearing alleyways with shovels by hand and working hand in hand with the Department of Sanitation here in New York City.
The Marines worked mainly in two Brooklyn neighborhoods, Breezy Point and Far Rockaway, on a peninsula just south of Brooklyn. Irish says they started on Sunday morning the 4th in Far Rockaway pumping water out of homes and apartment complexes. They're pumping water from homes back into the ocean using 150 and 600 gallon per minute water pumps. Lieutenant Irish says the pumps are a 24-hour operation.
So once those are set up and in place to pump water back out from people's homes and common areas back into the ocean, they're left to run overnight with a Marine to stand watch on them.
Irish said the Marines were given orders to help with pumping water out of homes, but says much of the work also involves giving residents assistance in any way they can.
The residents are working as hard and as fast as possible to get items out of their home that were water damaged and to rip drywall down. And that's where the Marines come in. They're not actually entering anyone's homes, but they are going and helping residents where need be move that debris out of the alleyways, out of the streets so that, you know, construction vehicles, sanitation trucks, what have you, can move into the area and continue the pace of the cleanup.
The Marines are also working with the city and other relief organizations, such as FEMA, to find out where they are most needed. They've also been led by the relief efforts to essential resources, such as gas.
There's not a day that goes by that, you know, you won't see a Marine that's walking up to a police officer or a firefighter and just seeing what needs to be done.
At the end of the day, they sleep at a local Marine Reserve unit in Brooklyn, which they've also been lent to run their operation. We spoke with another public information officer for 8th Engineers Support Battalion, Lieutenant James Stanger, on Wednesday morning. That morning, they were pumping water out of homes and clearing roads.
The Marines were focusing a lot on just route clearance, basically getting in between some of the houses here. Some of the houses are pretty close together, and there was a lot of debris there. From my understanding, when they first arrived here, that was very cluttered, and there was a lot of debris. And they they did an excellent job, again, in conjunction with FEMA and Northern Command and everyone else that's working here. They did an excellent job at consolidating a lot of the debris to then be moved to consolidation or a dump site.
Stenger said that after the morning's work, New York's Department of Sanitation took over the last phases of the cleanup.
We've actually basically ceased operations here, and they're essentially going back to our staging point, cleaning their vehicles, maintaining the fleet of vehicles that we brought up here, cleaning out the pumps that we've used, all in order to stage them, probably some more cleaning tomorrow. And then after that point, like I said, we'll be departing to go back down to Camp Lejeune.
Lieutenant Stenger tells me there's still a lot of work to be done on the island. But after the morning's work on Wednesday, the Marines left Breezy Point and went back to the Marine Reserve Unit across the bridge. They're now cleaning their tactical vehicles and water pumps and will soon be returning to North Carolina. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. After being declared extinct in 1987, red wolves have made a comeback thanks to the North Carolina Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Wolf Recovery Program. But some believe their populations are being threatened yet again, since a nighttime hunting rule that allows spotlight hunting of coyotes went into effect August 1st, three red wolves have been shot and killed. Concerned groups are asking a state court to stop the spotlight hunting in an effort to save the endangered red wolf.
Gunshot mortality is already the leading cause of death of red wolves in eastern North Carolina. Allowing this hunting will increase the death of red wolves from gunshots.
Senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center, Derb Carter, says hunters could easily mistake a red wolf for a coyote because they look almost identical.
It's difficult to distinguish during the day, much less at night, when often all you're seeing is a shadow and some eye shine. A small red wolf resembles closely a large coyote, and at night it would be almost impossible to tell them apart.
This week, we sought comment from the Wildlife Resources Commission, but was referred instead to the State Attorney General's office representing the commission. They put us in contact with attorney Norman Young, but he too turned us down, saying,
"My general practice is not to comment on any kind of pending litigation."
Southern Environmental Law Center attorney Derb Carter did agree to speak with us. He is representing Defenders of Wildlife, the Red Wolf Coalition, and the Animal Welfare Institute. Those three organizations have challenged the spotlight hunting regulation issued by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Carter argues the WRC did not follow the proper procedures in adopting the rule.
We've also informed the State Wildlife Commission that it is in violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act because it's specifically authorizing activities that would result in the taking of an endangered species, which of course is the red wolf.
Red wolves can be heard and in some rare instances seen in southeastern North Carolina. Red wolves were put on the endangered species list in 1973. That's when biologists sought to capture as many possible to put into a captive breeding program.
The Fish and Wildlife Service essentially, to save the animal, made the animal extinct in the wild.
Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Wolf Recovery Program, David Braben, says they carefully considered which natural habitat would be the new home for the wild red wolf population.
At the time, we were kind of looking around throughout the southeast, which would have been within the species' historic range. We settled on North Carolina because eastern North Carolina provided good habitat. It provided a good prey base for the animals. It had a low human population density, and it also had, at the time, no coyotes.
Coyote populations in North Carolina have steadily risen over the past decade. The non-native species started moving into our area as a result of territory expansion and being brought in illegally from other states. Raven says there are several complications with coyotes and red wolves coexisting, such as hybridization.
They have basically moved out of the west and along the way bred with wolves and bred with dogs. So the coyote that we have here in the East is actually a hybrid. It's an animal that still retains a lot of the coyote characteristics. We still call it a coyote, but in fact it's taken on some of these other characteristics too of dogs and wolves. It's often the case it's gotten a little bigger. They may take on the pack characteristics or hunting in packs. They can take on a little more like wolf-like characteristics, wolf-like behaviors.
While North Carolina is seeing an uptick in coyote populations, Rabin says the number of red wolves is dwindling. Current estimates put the number of red wolves in existence at between 100 and 120. Last month, the Southern Environmental Law Center asked the North Carolina Fish and Wildlife Service to confirm any red wolf deaths that have occurred since the nighttime hunting rule took effect. So far, three red wolves have been killed, all from gunshot wounds.
Being ongoing investigations, I can't speak too much about them, but all of those deaths have occurred within the 5-county area of eastern North Carolina that's considered the red wolf recovery area.
According to the Associated Press, the most recent red wolf was found last week near Creswell on the Washington and Terrell County line. The second red wolf death occurred in Beaufort County and the first in Terrell County. All three were wearing radio tracking collars. Rabin believes the new night hunting regulation is only partially to blame. He says in the past several years, the State Fish and Wildlife Service have noted an increase in the number of red wolf deaths, whether by illegal take, which includes gunshot mortality, trapping, or poisoning, or legal take, like an accidental strike from a vehicle.
Our concerns about the night hunting rule, which we expressed to the state, were that it would likely exacerbate an existing problem. And the existing problem was that we were already experiencing increasing levels, high levels of unnatural mortality, and especially the suspected illegal take kind.
According to a press release from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on November 15th, another red wolf was recently found dead north of Fairfield in Hyde County. It's the fourth radio-collared red wolf taken since September. For more information on the North Carolina Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Wolf Recovery Program and to see pictures of the red wolf, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with your local Edward Jones Financial Advisors, Kevin Page and Dan Roberts in New Bern, and Lewis Baylog in Havelock. Branch location information available at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, making sense of investing.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Next week is Thanksgiving. Ever since I was a child, it's been my absolute most favorite holiday. The only requirements are getting together with people you care about and eating. And I enjoy both of those things so much. What are you planning for this year's Thanksgiving holiday? How about choosing some fresh, seasonal foods, especially if you can find some grown regionally? You may think that the farmers market season is over, but many of our farm stands and markets are still open this time of year, especially on the weekends or around Thanksgiving and Christmas. They're open because there are some wonderful vegetables that grow in eastern North Carolina this time of year, and you can't beat the flavor of fresh vegetables recently picked in your Thanksgiving meal, or any meal for this time of year, for that matter. So what should you look for? What is actually growing fresh right now in eastern North Carolina? Well, start with broccoli. Beautiful heads of broccoli should be available at most any farm stand or market. You can do broccoli a couple different ways. The main thing is either don't overcook the broccoli, meaning leave it with a little bit of texture. You don't want it mushy with a bad mouthfeel. You can achieve that with steaming, or my new favorite, oven roasting until it starts browning on the edges. And then flavor it with something wonderful. I recently found a sauce made with fish sauce and garlic and pepper that makes broccoli amazing. Today, I read of a different way to cook broccoli. If you're going to overcook it, really overcook it. This recipe suggested steaming it lightly and then cooking it at a very low temperature in lots of olive oil and garlic for 2 hours until it essentially dissolves and becomes completely softened. You then can spread it on toast or toss it with pasta, like a cooked pesto. So either don't overcook it or really overcook it. And then chard. If you've not eaten chard, now's the time to try. The leaves are thick but tender and are actually velvety in a salad. This time of year, I can't make a salad without including those dark green, beautiful chard leaves. It's also wonderful when quickly sautéed or when added to any soup or broth. Try some chard, another seasonal food here in eastern North Carolina. Of course, you've all heard about kale recently. Everyone's talking about it. It adds lots of color and flavor and amazing nutrients to any dish. And kale is growing in every garden and many farms in eastern North Carolina right now. You can make dried kale chips or steam the kale, saute the kale, add it to pasta, anything you want to do. There are a couple different kales to choose from. The more old-fashioned curly kale that we're used to has a firmer texture and a stronger flavor. It's what I grew up with, and I love it. There's also dinosaur kale, a kale that is much more mild and tender, has long, thin leaves. It's more cabbagey than the original kale as far as texture and tenderness. What else is growing locally? Well, something you have every Thanksgiving, but maybe try something different with them this year, sweet potatoes. My newest favorite way with sweet potatoes is to cut it in cubes, roast it in the oven, and then toss it with a roasted red pepper vinaigrette. Oh my heavens, what a wonderful way to eat sweet potatoes. Finally, right now is the time for turnips and rutabagas. Eat them the old-fashioned way, mashed with butter and cream, lots of black pepper, or try slicing them into little matchsticks and pickling them and serving them on a sandwich or in a salad. Just go out, find your local farm stand, and see what you can get that's a local seasonal food for this Thanksgiving. I guarantee you won't be sorry. And if you're not sure how to cook these particular vegetables, well, I'm having a cooking class on November 29th here in Carteret County at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're going to cook some of the recipes I just talked about. So give us a call at the office at 252-222-6359. To sign up for that class. In any event, have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This is the Downey's Journal. With the holiday season underway, you know that many meals will be shared. When people eat, they talk, and given enough talk, they'll tell you about what they eat. That's the concept behind Amy Rogers' collection of stories and recipes entitled Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas. George Olson spoke with the Charlotte resident and has this, which originally aired in May 2004.
It's pretty easy to thumb through Hungry for Home and say cookbook, period, and you wouldn't be wrong. There are over 200 recipes in the book from over 100 contributors, including some from noted authors like Jill McCorkle and Jerry Bledsoe, but primarily from non-professional chefs that Amy Rogers calls home cooks. Whether from writers or non-writers, virtually all the recipes come with a story, some which only vaguely have some tie to the recipe itself, but all with some type of emotional tie to the end product. That can seem somewhat surprising when you're talking about a biscuit recipe, but Rogers thoroughly expected that type of conviction.
Just because we live in a region where there hasn't always been an abundance of food throughout the ages past doesn't mean that there's been a scarcity of tradition and culture. I think the fact that Carolinas are so rich with an oral tradition of storytelling really is shown through these recipes, because a recipe is something that can be just orally passed down, it can be written down, it becomes incorporated in who we are. I encountered so many people who had recipes that they prepared for generations past, and those were the stories that I enjoyed the most.
Some of the stories don't even really involve food, such as this tale Amy Rogers wrote about peach farmer and author Dory Sanders, highlighting the ability of rural Southerners to take next to nothing and stretch it into something.
The peaches did not survive the early cold spring of 1997. What would Sanders do when the customers began arriving in June, looking for those wonderful peaches to put in pies, cobblers, and homemade ice cream? That was the summer Dory Sanders sold rocks. Not just any old rocks, but 100% genuine farm rocks, each with its own certificate of authenticity. She sold them to kids, and she sold them to grown-ups. She carefully washed the peach-sized hunks of rosy quartz, polished them up to look pretty, set them out on the farm stand tables, and when people stopped by to ask what she was doing, she told them, "We don't have any peaches today, but we do have farm rocks that you can take home with you."
For Rogers, Dory Sanders is perhaps the epitome of the home cooks who contributed recipes and their related stories, talented, resourceful, and equal parts ready to share or talk about food.
Well, I think it's interesting because the Carolinas are such a place of great storytellers that it only makes sense that we would also be great storytellers when it comes to food. Dory Sanders, the wonderful author and peach farmer, is fond of saying, "If it weren't for food and who died, we wouldn't have anything to talk about."
Having to talk about food is one of the reasons the job description for cookbook author has to be among life's more pleasant, though it probably doesn't outweigh the fact a cookbook author has to be a willing sampler of much food. That was the case for Rogers in putting together Hungry for Home. She says of the 200-plus recipes in the book, she attempted to make or at least sampled almost all of them. Rogers says as a journalist, she often uses food to explore a region's culture. It was recipes she decided not to taste test that said the most about the South, where we are contrasted to where we've been.
Some of the traditions, which are at least a generation or two removed from our daily lives, are the ones that still kind of make me think twice about who we are and how far we've come. We do have recipes for snapping turtle, and we do have recipes for possum. And I confess to not having tried those, although Doris Davis, who submitted them to us, has done them, and she recognizes that that was not that long ago the way some people ate routinely. So that's a tradition that's very important to recognize here. I don't attempt to supersede her ability to cook a possum, I will tell you that.
Even if she had the will to supersede someone else's ability to cook a possum, she might not have the touch. If there's one thing Rogers has learned in talking with and observing the home cooks who contributed to Hungry for Home, it's that intangibles are everything.
I think there's something in every recipe that's a bit intuitive, even if it's spelled out as clearly as you can imagine. I think every cook has his or her own touch, but the best cooks are not typically the ones who do measure.
That is the case with Virginia Jackson, whose buttermilk biscuit recipe appears midway through the book. The recipe involves a grand total of 3 ingredients, which leads one to think, how hard can it be? Hard? No. Able to successfully replicate? Perhaps not. In an essay accompanying Jackson's recipe, Rogers speculates why.
Virginia can't remember all the contests she's won, but she never forgets the key to making perfect biscuits. She advises this: keep your mind on what you're doing, don't just throw them together, and forget using a mixer or even a spoon. Virginia mixes every batch with her hands. It seems so simple, 3 ingredients. So there must be a secret, something that makes one biscuit or cake or pie or bread different and special. If that something doesn't come from the store or out of a book, where does it come from? Can it be measured like so much flour and shortening? In Virginia Jackson's strong brown hands lies at least part of the secret. When your hands have worked the fields, tamed a garden, and cared for children, almost anything is possible. Virginia's touch is unique. A talent like hers can be learned, but it comes only by doing, with care and with practice. And learning takes time, an investment too few are willing to make. But there's something else still, something that comes from the heart. I went to Virginia Jackson's house back in 1994, I think it was, because I had found out through my own research that she was the Blue Ribbon biscuit baker for all of North Carolina. She had won the Blue Ribbon at the State Fair. So I called up Miss Jackson, and she very kindly allowed me to come to her house and watch her make biscuits. and I felt like I was in the presence of true magic. I watched what she was doing. She wrote down the recipe. I took the recipe home with me, and then I sat down to do those biscuits, and they were pretty good, but they were not as good as hers. Not because I did anything wrong, but because, as I say in the story, your hands learn almost kind of without your mind telling them when something is right. And that only comes with time and practice.
Amy Rogers is the author of Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas, which is published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
This is the Downeast Journal. A tradition around some Thanksgiving tables is for everyone seated to share one thing they are thankful for this year. Since commentator Joan Karas can't make your Thanksgiving Day feast, she'd like to share with you now all the things that she's appreciative of.
Every year in late autumn, the early American pilgrims emerge from their textbooks to remind us that we should be thankful for our blessings. We all learn in first grade that those early immigrants celebrated their first harvest with corn and cranberries and wild turkey, thanks to a lot of help from Native Americans. That old wild turkey was such a savvy critter that Benjamin Franklin believed he should be our national bird. Today, think how easy it is to bag a turkey at any grocery store. How things change. I have a growing sense of how thankful I need to be. Now that I'm an antique person with some white hair, not all, just some white hair. A long list of doctors know me. The pharmacist is one of my closest friends. I'm grateful to have those people in my life. Of course, it's natural to give thanks for our health, our families and friends, modern cars that rarely give trouble, and the beautiful state of North Carolina. Yet I am learning that life is stuffed with other, subtler blessings. For instance, my cell phone sleeps in my purse, not with me. When our kids were young, I was on call all the time, so I know how to live like that, and I'm not doing it anymore. I'm sure that when the roll is called up yonder, God will not ask if I texted to let him know I was on the way. We are a country of fads, so I am grateful that the fad of scrapbooking did not grab me, that I don't feel compelled to read the Shades of Grey trilogy, and that we still have white bread in the house. I know we're supposed to look at white bread and go, "Ugh, bad." But when we have roast meats in the fridge, I want a sandwich with mayonnaise, lettuce, meat, and white bread. And I don't care how many dietitians are listening. Ever so slowly, I am learning to ask myself, is this really important? Not natural for a professional worrywart, yet this could be the best blessing of all. For example, when traffic comes to a standstill, causing me to wait and wait in my car, not knowing what idiot created such a mess, it is okay. Really, it is. The idiot will pay for his mistake. So I should just pull out my book and read peacefully until traffic moves again. When someone's undisciplined child screams endlessly while I'm trying to shop or to think or to appreciate nature, I say to myself, not really important. Now and then I sail by the clueless parent and allow myself to say, I'm so thankful he is yours. When it rains several days in a row and a tire on your car has gone flat, you're out of milk and out of patience altogether, remember, none of that stuff is really important. You know what's important and why you give thanks.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.